Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Support for this podcast comes from Codex Digital. The Codex workflow is an end-to-end camera-to-post system that makes production easier and more efficient than ever before. Find out more at CodexDigital.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX podcast. You know, we talk a lot at FX Guide and FX PhD about the lines between previs, production, and post-production blurring or just being eliminated. In today's podcast, I think you'll see that in practice as we talk with Eric Nash, visual effects supervisor from Digital Domain, on the film Real Steel. Before we get to that, over at FX Guide on the main site, we've added a new version of the Art of Roto, part of our Art of series, which has been very popular. This is one of them that fell offline during the site upgrade when we moved the site. For some reason, this one didn't quite make it. So in addition to relocating it and getting it online after somebody pointed it out to us, Mike took the time to really update it for 2011. And I think you'll see it's very comprehensive. Somebody pointed out to me that I don't think Mike left anything out of this article. This is very comprehensive. These are the kind of things we really like to do over at FX Guide. And when I try to explain the sites and what we're trying to do, this is the kind of thing I really point to because, you know, we look at the visual effects business from every angle, history, training, business issues, and, of course, talking to filmmakers about latest work and techniques and things like that. It just all works together. Speaking of which, the new term just started over at FX PhD. We've got a ton of new courses, just to point out a few of them. Surely the favorite named course we've ever had, the Nuke Zombie Apocalypse. You want to check that out if you're a Nuke artist or interested in Nuke in any way. We've also got a new course on Red Epic Grading Workflow, which, you know, obviously FX Guide, FX PhD has had a Red camera since number 22, and we've got early Epic and Epic X cameras, so we're really well positioned to present an update to the... We've been doing training on the Red since the very beginning, but really focus on grading and workflows for the Red Epic. So you want to check that out. Also, taking that a little further on the color side, we've got the Craft of Color, one of the craft kind of training courses we've doing. And I'm really excited about this one. We've also got a new Python Fundamentals for the Pipeline course, which ought to be very interesting to you if you have any interest in, you know, the overall facility pipeline and really working with Python to help streamline things. We've got our first ever character animation course, Introduction to Character Animation. And this is just the first few courses that we have listed on our on the page over at fxphd.com. So you want to check those out. Check out what else we're offering, as well as the O-Week video is available, the Orientation Week video that kind of takes you through a quick overview of all the courses and lets you get a little preview. Head on over to FXPhD and check that out. All right, so let's jump into today's podcast with Eric Nash talking about the film Real Steel. Mike starts off talking to him about the changes that have happened really from working on iRobot to Real Steel, two robot films done at the same house over a period of a little bit of distance between the two. So I think it's an interesting way to start off talking about the movie Real Steel. Here's Mike Seymour with Eric Nash.
So Eric, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
So look, I really enjoyed this film. I enjoyed it actually even more than I thought I was, and I thought I was going to enjoy it. But,
well, that's good to hear.
Yeah, no, it's really, really good. I just thought it was terrific. But of course, the film at its core, I'm not giving anything away because this is very much front of house, is fighting robots. And so by way of comparison, I was wondering if we could compare and contrast another robot film that you did, which is iRobot, with yep. Real Steel. Because this is a film from,
Absolutely.
What, 2004, iRobot?
Yep.
And let's just go right out
a
of the gate.
A lifetime ago.
Yeah, I was going to say, because it was shot on film for a start, right? Which completely
yes.
dictates
And
your
although
pipeline.
We used motion capture on iRobot, we on iRobot didn't have access to the very state-of-the-art virtual production tools that we used to great effect on Real Steel.
So I guess let's start at the onset environment. In an iRobot environment, you're going to get a feed off a video tap, which is, of course, you know, not very high res and has to interrupt the film pipeline effectively to sneak a bit of light. On this pipeline, you were shooting on what, the S35?
The Sony F-35,
yeah.
Which is a an HD res camera, but with a Super 35 size chip, so you get film style depth of field, but you're capturing 1920 by 1080. It was a 2:3:5 aspect ratio show, so we were not even using the full 1080 high pixel dimension.
But you get a much better picture on set.
Absolutely.
So I'm wondering, did you...
On set, we're getting an HD, totally clean, no ground glass, no reticle built into it. So we could use our simulcam technology and have really good-looking on-set live composites that served as the first-generation temps for all the robot visual effect shots.
So when you were shooting iRobot, if you wanted to frame up a shot, I think you had a rehearsal with a stand-in kind of proxy for the robot. And then obviously you'd want to shoot a clean plate, and then you'd probably put in a dummy thing for lighting reference and stuff. But what was the procedure,
right,
and how did that change when you got to setting up?
Well, there were two types of shots we did on Real Steel. There were shots that were very similar to that, where we would use what we called IBC, or image-based capture. And these were shots that were typically outside the ring, where there was human-robot interaction. And in that case, it was very much like iRobot. We had a guy in spandex suit. One difference was, because of the height of the robots, our performers usually wore painter's stilts to get their head up to the 7.5 to 8.5 foot height that is what our robots were ultimately. But for those scenes where there was interaction between the humans and the robots, we did it that way. And that was pretty much the same as it was on iRobot. The big difference came when we were in the ring and the robots are fighting. In that case, we did it completely differently from how we did iRobot, and we leveraged a lot of the technology that was developed for Avatar in terms of motion capture, and then playing back pre-captured animation on set, tracking the taking camera in real time using motion capture technology, and then rendering those pre-captured robots live, compositing them over the plate that you're shooting, so that the operator and the director are framing the shot and getting to see the robots in action in real time as we're shooting the plates.
So was that large capture space aided by Giant Studios? Is that where they played a role?
Yeah. Each venue where we did robot boxing, their crew would go in several days ahead of time and build the volume around that fighting environment. It's not as dense a capture volume as is necessary for performance capture, because you only have one object that you're tracking, and that's the camera, and it has no moving parts. It's basically a fixed object, or a fixed size and shape object that you're tracking its movement and orientation through space. So when we're capturing the boxing, which was done ahead of time before we went to Detroit for principal photography, that was done on Giant Stage, which is, I think like an 80 or so camera volume. When we were doing simulcam and all we needed to capture on set was camera position and orientation, we got away with a smaller number of cameras, but a larger area.
So just to be clear about that, so when you've got Sugar Ray Leonard or somebody who's giving you the boxing stuff, obviously that's just a what we might think of as a cutting-edge traditional motion capture. You retarget that into the robot performance. That robot performance is then effectively, well, effectively pre-animated.
Playback.
Yeah, but then that's...
Playback on set.
But is it still being rendered at the point of the Detroit shoot? Because otherwise, if you, because if you move the camera, you wouldn't get the perspective shift. Okay, so you've worked out the animation, but you haven't actually rendered it. Now, you're rendering it in real time so that as a motion-captured camera walks around an otherwise completely empty piece of staging, which is the ring, it's telling it the camera, it's telling the computer, so where the camera is, to render that right so you can pre-comp so that when you're looking at your split, you can frame up on the action.
Exactly.
But that would, that so the limitations on that, because that sounds awesome, but the limitation of that presumably is that it's only going to go so far, especially with lighting, because it can't be aware of the lights in the arena. So
And the level that were the fidelity of the render, which was absolutely fine and better than I anticipated initially. We're using Motion Builder as our rendering engine, and we have shadows, and the the quality is as good as most previs you see, and more than good enough for what it's being used for in terms of determining whether or not the plate you just shot works for that action. It works. The rendering is more than good enough as a first-generation temp for the editor to cut with to make sure that that plate with that robot action in it is going to work as a shot. So, it doesn't have, the robots don't shadow each other. You don't have motion blur. You don't have any of the real refinements that ultimately you want, but it gives you everything you need to know on the day as you're shooting.
Well, I must say, I really liked the cinematography in this, and I'm going to come back to that point, because away from anything else, I think the film is just beautifully shot and the look was great. But the point you're making about that framing was really critical, because there's plot points, especially at the last round of the fighting, where the framing of Hugh Jackman's character versus what's going on the ring is absolutely critical. And I'm hoping that this would have meant you didn't have to like just shoot super wide and kind of rebuild huge amounts of set.
No, that in terms of, get past the geek factor and how cool it is to be able to see these robots through the camera, and that's all great, but what it gives to the filmmaker, and to me was the biggest benefit of this process, was it allows Sean and Mauro and Dave Emmerich, the camera operator, to shoot the robots boxing the way they would shoot humans boxing. There's no sort of after the fact, iterative process, trying to take this empty plate that was shot relatively blindly and trying to shoehorn action into it. It's shot, it's completely interactive and visceral, because when Dave Emmerich is standing there in the ring with the Steadicam, he's looking at robots. He's reacting to what the robots are doing, and he's doing it in real space, in real time, and I think it shows in the camera work of the fighting. It doesn't have that very sort of sterile, calculated quality that is so often comes with visual effect shots, just because of the process through which they evolve.
Oh, absolutely. I think like the cinematography was spectacular. And in fact, the DOP from this was on Avatar, right?
Yep.
Yeah. But so the operator, I don't know if he operated himself, but let's assume that there's an operator and the DOP was not operating. What's the operator seeing? Is the operator got an eyepiece that's getting a feedback, or is the operator, how's the operator?
If he's, if he's on Steadicam, because of the nature of the Steadicam, they're always looking at a remote monitor you know, that's mounted, you know, if they're in Steadicam high mode, the camera's up high and the monitor's down low on the counterweight. And we would take the feed from the camera. It would go to our technology truck. The rendered robots would be composited into that live feed and sent back to the Steadicam and put on his monitor, whether it's you know, a 6-inch monitor on his Steadicam or the eyepiece on the F-35 if he's shooting it shoulder mounted. We run, he gets that feed back from our technology truck and sees it in whatever viewfinder he would use otherwise.
Because in the first case, when you're motion capturing, say, a boxer in a ring, you can have a virtual camera, which could be basically four sticks in a sort of a cross with a feed from the camera. And, of course, you don't expect to see the stage. You expect to see a sort of a, you know, low poly count piece of animation. So there is no lensing on the thing that you're holding in that stage. But in this situation, you're not only seeing back that framing with the robot in that motion capture sense, but you're also actually capturing the hero plate photography that will be the plate photography for that shot.
Absolutely.
So and my question would be the lag.
That is,
the point there would be, if I was in a pre-pro meeting for this, is you'd need to get the lag really low, because if there was a lag time from that going out, rendering coming back, and I moved to the right and it took a beat for the image to update, it would be impossible virtually to operate.
Yes, and it is, there is a discernible latency. I think it typically is in the 2 to 3 frames out of 24 per second, which is, it's on the ragged edge of being unacceptable, and it's it took a little adjustment on Dave's part to get used to it, but for all intents and purposes, that latency was small enough that it didn't slow us down. It didn't hinder his operating or the end result.
So if I could just go through the stages, because I know we did this in a story on iRobot in 2004. So let me read back that. In 2004, we had logged that what you did for a plate, not talking about the boxing type scenario now, is you obviously did rehearsal with the stand-in. You'd do the actors with a proxy. You'd do the actors without a proxy. You'd get a fully clean plate. Then you'd stand a giant 2-meter robot in just for lighting reference. Then you'd do a chrome ball, 8 gray ball, and an HDR pass. And the HDR pass, if I remember, was a stills automated kind of thing. Okay, so what's changed there? Is that stage for the one, like, say, when he's teaching the robot to dance for the first time, it's out in the sort of car park of the motel. Is that changed dramatically, or is that sort of still a good snapshot?
It's gotten simpler. With him out in the car park, again, you got the guy in the suit, and that is... and it was sort of on iRobot, the intention was to shoot one with the proxy, but hopefully use the one without the proxy as the hero. But more often than not, the preferred take was the one with the proxy. We took that as a lesson, and that, among other things, on Real Steel, we decided that the performance is always going to be better for the human that's also in the shot when they're acting against the proxy. So we accepted that we're going to have to paint these guys out because they don't ever get completely covered up by the robot. But we sort of bit our tongue and accepted the reality that the plate we're going to wind up using is going to have the guy in the spandex jammies in it.
I guess also in this particular case, unlike with Will Smith, you had a very much younger actor who obviously probably doesn't have the same level of, you know, I mean, because eyeline and stuff is one of the things that dictates that performance pick, right?
Yes. And I mean, Hugh is an absolute prince on set, and he was really professional and, you know, willing to do anything and everything to make this movie the best it could be. But conversely, we went out of our way to make it as simple and time efficient as we could. So to get back to your question of what was different, it was a much less rigid structure in terms of the things we needed to get. We have abandoned the chrome and gray balls, so that part is gone completely. The HDRs have gotten much quicker. The cameras can shoot a much longer sequence without having the buffer fill up. And it turns out that a manually operated tiling head is actually faster than an automated one. So in some regards, the HDR process has gotten more low-tech, but with the newer digital cameras, we're able to go faster. So we still do the HDR stills. We still have, for most or some of the robots, we had a robot reference. What one of the differences this time around was we didn't do it on every setup. We did it more on a per environment basis. So if we were doing like the sequence in the car park that maybe had, I don't know, 4 to 6 different setups, rather than wheel the robot lighting reference in for every setup, we would do it for 1, maybe 2 setups, and that reference would apply to all the other setups. Similarly, in terms of getting a clean plate, we would look at the specifics of the shot and determine what we needed. We wouldn't always, just as a matter of course, shoot a complete take to get the clean background. If it was a deep, distant background and the camera was dollying laterally, we would often determine that we've got what we need in the plate itself to reconstruct the background and paint out the guy in spandex.
I was going to ask you about that, because in the scene where Hugh Grant is shadowboxing, there's the very start of Hugh starting to train the robot. I noticed the camera does this wonderful track, camera left to right, then it stops in shot and then starts going back the other way. And I was thinking, as you were speaking then, God, you would have loved to have had a simple motion control on that, because that would have made life a lot simpler. But you just would have lifted it from what was otherwise revealed.
Yep. And that was one of those shots where we didn't need a clean plate, because there was a good amount of depth between where the robot performer was and the background that he was occluding. We knew that, and the background was relatively static other than motion due to the camera moving. We knew that we could reconstruct what he was covering up from different parts of the shot. So in that case, especially because it was such a big, long take.
Yeah, it was really long.
And what's in the movie is just part of it. I think we went up and down that dolly track 3 or 4 times on one take. So we knew as we were shooting, it's like, we don't need a clean plate for this one. We have what we need. So in that case, it was the take with the robot performer mimicking Hugh. As soon as Sean got the take he liked, we would bring out the HDR camera, shoot the HDRs, and move on, pretty much.
So we've been joking about iRobot versus real still, but there's a big thing in the middle in terms of HDRs, which is the work you did with Benjamin Button. And I was really impressed with DD's work on Benjamin Button in terms of the HDRs being dynamic HDRs that would sort of interpolate through changing lighting environments. So what we've been discussing, when they're outside and they're standing still and shadow boxing, I can see an HDR taken at a spot working for like multiple shots even. But when you've got your robot walking from the locker room out into the stadium, an HDR taken at the start of that walk is going to produce vastly different results than an HDR further down. Did you do any kind of multiple updating HDR stuff? I assume you must have.
We did. Whenever we did something like that, we would, like for the shot you're talking about where Adam enters the arena for the final fight, I believe there were at least three, if not four, different HDR sets taken at different locations along his path for that very reason, because of the changing of the lighting conditions. The other thing that we did on this show, which is a first for any movie I've worked on, is typically the HDR creates, you know, an environmental sphere that has all the lighting information in it. But it has no sort of distance information.
Yep.
And what we did on Real Steel was, and it was particularly effective in what is basically our first robot shot in the movie, the one where Ambush, the robot that's sitting in the truck at the county fair, stands up and walks from the very deepest part of the truck out to the lift gate. We took that HDR, actually, I believe there were at least two HDRs for that, one from the liftgate and one from deep inside the truck, but took those HDRs and projected them onto survey geometry of the inside of the truck so that the windows and the cabinets and all of the different surfaces in the truck are lighting the robot based on their proximity to the robot, not just all of these different HDR values mapped on the inside of a sphere. So as the robot moves through the truck and through the pools of light that are coming in through the window, there's an accurate spatial relationship between the robot and the light sources that are affecting him.
I'm so glad you brought that shot up, because I love that shot. But one of the things that struck me about that was not only how accurate the lighting was, but just how wonderfully interactive you'd set up the shot. So there was tons of things he bumped and contact stuff. Did all of that stuff tend to get rigged in camera, or was your team also responsible for introducing props that could then interact with the robot to make them not just isolated animations?
Well, funny you should ask. Because that shot was a bear. When we shot that, we had Garrett Warren, our stunt coordinator, was the performer standing in for Ambush, and the Legacy Effects team had made a set of shoulder pads that were the same width and height as the shoulders of the robot that Garrett could wear. He had a helmet on and he had arm extensions. So we had basically built him up to be as close to the size and shape of the robot that was going to replace him as he could be. The problem, and all of those, there was all this hanging stuff in the truck that he had to move through on his way out of the truck and bang around through it. The problem was it was such a tight fit when he was up to the proper height with the shoulder pads and the helmet and the arm extensions that for him to make his way through the truck, he had it jostled him about pretty dramatically. And as we were into the animation phase of working on that shot, Sean felt that the stuff that he was running into was affecting him too much. So he basically threw away the animation that was derived from the performer walking through the truck and gave him a much more direct and powerful walk through the truck. What it ultimately meant was all of that great interactive stuff that Garrett banged his way through had to be replaced.
Right, so because if a 200-pound thing hits a teapot, the teapot suffers, but if the teapot hits a guy, maybe they both react a bit. Is that what you're sort of saying?
Exactly.
Right.
So we wound up having to reconstruct a significant part of the inside of that truck digitally, and all of the things that he bangs into and interact with were done digitally as well.
Which, okay, so this next is my next question. Now, when you're talking about the guy outside on the painter's stilts, and for that matter, this setup with the actor, we're not talking about any kind of motion capture of these guys, are we? Because it's just like visual reference, because presumably all their limbs would be in the wrong place, all their joints would be in the wrong place, their whole motion would be wrong.
Well, but we're still capturing, it's more than just reference, because when we did this type of shot, we had multiple witness cameras, anywhere from 3 to 6 additional angles, and Giant Studios was responsible for extracting that animation data and delivering it to us, just as they delivered the more traditional motion capture for the fight sequences. So we were still using a form of motion capture, and it's a form that we refer to as IBC, or image-based capture. Now, one of the things we found out along the way was, because of the stilts and partly because of, like you said, the different proportions of the performer, but mostly because of what walking in those stilts did to the performer's gait, a lot of that IBC motion capture data we wound up not using.
Because I'm right in thinking that if you put an extension on my leg from my knee, obviously it extends my point where I touch the ground down, I'm effectively lifting, relatively speaking, my knee joint up. And if you were to use that, I'd look like Jar Jar Binks, and we don't really like Jar Jar Binks' walk, so it doesn't look robotic.
I mean, Giant had some very clever ways of retargeting that took all those joints in the wrong places and put them, you know, map them onto the robot's skeleton appropriately, but the end result was you'd then see the robot moving, and you could tell in the way the robot was moving that he's walking like a guy on painter's stilts.
Yeah.
And it was funny how apparent that was.
Because he'd have to actually, I mean, obviously to walk, you'd have to lift the weight that is the stilt below your foot, which by definition, I guess, would pivot your hips differently than a robot would need to.
Yeah, and I'm not an expert on biomechanics, but having that all that extension added below the knee, you know, does strange things to the way you walk and you bend your knees and how you're balancing. And it's all of those subtleties that are, you know, show up in the motion capture data, and then when you apply it to the robot, you go, boy, it looks awkward. And part of our hope going in was that slight awkwardness would, you know, add to the robotic quality. It turns out that it doesn't. It just makes the robot walk like a guy on stilts.
Can I change subjects now and just discuss it
sure.
in terms of green screen? Because it struck me that, you know, it seems like some of these plates you're just shooting and the robot is just going to be obscured by the tailgate of a truck or something. But there are a lot of other scenes where I couldn't imagine how you'd get a green screen in there. So you'd have had to have just done tons of roto. Did you use much green screen, or was it really a roto exercise?
Very little.
Right.
Very little green screen. Really, the only place we used green screen to any extent was in the arenas and we used it. We always had extras in close around the ring and maybe into the first couple rows of the tiered seating in the arenas, but we would get that far away and we would have run out of our allotment of extras. So behind that last row of extras is where we hung our relatively small, I think it was like an 8 foot high by, I mean, we had enough to go all the way around the arena, but it was really just this very short band just to isolate the heads and shoulders of the last row of real people before we had our digital.
Was that the same when you were doing iRobot, that you didn't really use much green screen, or was that...
There was a lot more green screen on iRobot because we had more purely virtual environments.
Right.
Or heavily virtual environments. The whole interior of the office tower that the big climactic battle takes place, that was, I mean, there was a set, but it was a partial set. So tons of green screen there. Also on the factory floor where Sunny is hiding. A lot of green screen there. But not much on real steel.
Okay, so can I walk you through now the technical path, because we've established a shooting on the Sony. You've got a 1920 by 1080, but what color space are you coming out of that camera? Presumably it's a log file, but are you going then straight into an OpenEXR when you get to DD, or what's the pipe in on your footage?
Boy, I hope I remember this right, because there was a lot of discussion about all this. It was definitely a log format we were getting out of the camera. It was basically the S-log. Yes, I believe we used the Sony S-log. It was
because I think they were recording on codecs, weren't they? Did you record on codecs?
Yes, recording on the codecs, which was a fabulous way to go, to not be swapping tapes. I will say that the one thing, and this was the first show that I worked on that was shot digitally, and I would be hard-pressed to come up with a reason from my selfish perspective to go back to shooting film. It was getting plates and getting, additional material was so much easier than working on film. I mean, oftentimes a shot would be turned over and we have the plate and we realize, you know what, for cleanup, it'd be nice to have an alternate take because we're missing this one section. And literally one phone call to the visual effects editor on the production side, and we would have the frames on a drive that afternoon.
Big difference between having that and scanning film, isn't it?
Oh, well, and with scanning, you're talking about real hard costs, and somebody's going, really, do you need all those frames? And they got to find the negative and put it up on the scanner. And this way, it's all just, there's no real expense to getting the footage, and it was really quick and easy. No dust busting to be done. You know, there's no negative dirt or scratches ever. It was great.
And when you were doing iRobot, you had a Nuke plugin, which was known as MakeBot, I think, which allowed you to basically get multiple passes in the OpenEXR that would give you a heck of a lot of flexibility at comp time. Was this the same approach, or were you not going for that kind of fully
No, it was similar. Because these robots didn't have the translucency issues that the robots on iRobot did. It wasn't nearly as complicated, and that was really the driving force behind MakeBot on iRobot. But we did a similar thing in terms of there being many layers or channels to the robot renders in terms of diffuse pass, spec pass, reflections, all of that, you know, in different EXR channels. So we did that. It just wasn't as complex a render as it was on iRobot. But on the topic of Nuke, I do want to point out one of the things we took advantage of Nuke with on this show was for the crowds in the arenas. My digital effects supervisor, Swin Gilberg, and his team came up with what I thought was a brilliant solution to populating the arenas. While we were shooting in Kobo Arena, which was actually played as two different arenas in the movie, we never had more than 500 extras, and both of the arenas in the movie ultimately look to seat anywhere from 12 to 20,000 people. So we had a lot of seats to fill, and Swin was determined, thankfully, to avoid a CG character solution to populating these arenas. So what he and his team came up with was a photographic solution where, in a separate space in Detroit, while we had extras, they set up a small green screen with multiple Sony, I'm trying to remember which, X1, X3, or... EX3.
Right.
It's sort of a prosumer HD camera. And took the extras on a green screen with a green box to sit on, shot from three different angles, and took them through a predetermined sequence of actions. Standing, clapping, sitting, cheering, so, arms up, and it
so
was
you're
like,
saying
I
that
believe,
in those stadium shots, those crowds are actual comps? You didn't use like a massive kind of solution?
Correct.
Wow.
Those are all, each person is a individual HD who shot HD on its side, so it was 16 by 9 with the 16 side vertical.
Yeah.
And shot multiple cameras so we could get different angles. And then they created a nuke script that made a card at each seat location. And based on where the virtual camera for the shot was, would determine which of the EX3 angles was most appropriate based on where the ultimate camera was, would select that angle automatically, and then you would prescribe based on what's happening in the fight at that moment which range of motion, whether it's, you know, pre-fight and everybody's just sort of mellow sitting in their seats, or, you know, end of the final round, everybody's on their feet going nuts.
No, so it would, Eric, can I clarify this? Were you saying that you're shooting individual extras or a bunch of extras in a box?
One at a time.
One at a time. So if you want to put 12,000 people in the stadium, you put 12,000 cards in a procedural manner. And then, of course, that allowed you to randomize, and presumably you could do some color correction randomization as well, just to...
Yep.
Oh, man.
And I think we were shooting the people, I think Swin said they shot like 65 people. So there may be 20,000 people in the arena, but there's only 65 different bodies out there.
Wow.
And occasionally you'd see somebody who kind of, you'd notice them multiple times, and we would just swap them out for somebody who didn't stand out.
Yeah, so that would have made a pretty big nuke script, I imagine.
What the beauty of it was done in sections, and the render times were insignificant. It worked great.
The great thing about that is, assuming that you just kill the green of the green screen that's surrounding them, you can have a pretty ropey key at that distance.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're talking about people that are usually, and as is always the case with these things, we wound up using them in a shot where they're much bigger in frame than we ever anticipated, and yet they held up because each person is, HD res. So we wound up using it more than we anticipated, and it avoided any of that massive rigmarole that can really be a long and winding road to get it to work.
The only thing I would think about that, and obviously it worked, so I'd be wrong, but the only thing I would think about that is that if you're shooting on a prosumer camera like that, you don't have the dynamic range that you're going to get out of an S-Log from an F-35 or, for that matter, anything else. And so I would have thought it would have been a little harder to grade that, given that those crowds occasionally had spotlights flying over them.
Well, we consciously lit them fairly flat, and for the most part, they're pretty dark. But, there was enough exposure that, when the spotlight wiped across, there was enough information there that we could crank way up, and it somehow it held up. I was pleasantly surprised. I wasn't a naysayer at the beginning. I thought it was an interesting approach, and I was, you know, wholeheartedly on board for the guys to give it a whirl, and it worked better than I think any of us ever imagined it would.
Yeah.
Ironically, while we were in the middle of finishing Real Steel, DreamWorks had got wind of this system and asked us to help them with one shot on the help that they needed to add people to. And that actually, we did that, and that shot was in the movie, worked great. And actually, I mean, that movie obviously came out before Real Steel did, so that was sort of the backdoor first version of this technique. And we didn't even shoot people specifically for it. We just stole, you know, some extras from Real Steel and plugged them in this other movie.
I was just trying to think about that because I've seen The Help. I can't think of a crowd sequence. What was the sequence in The Help?
It's a night exterior. There are people on the street in the deep background. And I think when they shot, they had maybe a couple dozen people and they wanted hundreds, or they had four or five and they wanted dozens.
Right. I think I do know the shot, actually, yeah. And she's coming home at the end of the night, yeah. Okay, well, look, this has been fascinating, but I just wanted to get back to that thing I mentioned earlier, which is the cinematography on this, because I thought it was beautiful.
Right.
And one of the things I loved that, of course, the F-35 helped you with was the depth of field that you could get. There were some really nice shots, even the ones that weren't effect shots, with lots of stacked up kind of soft focus and light and shallow depth of field and stuff. Did you shoot any of the effect shots and then sort of add back in some of that stuff later because you thought it'd be easier to have a bit more depth and then put it in post? Or was it pretty much the DOP got to shoot exactly the way they wanted and then you just engineered around it?
No, we had to do a lot of depth of field manipulation on robot shots. Our sort of working method was, and we actually, one of the other advantages of the virtual production, as we were shooting robots fighting in the ring, I thought that it would be helpful for the focus puller to have a readout or a display that would tell him where the two robots are relative to the camera, because Motion Builder knows where our camera is because we're tracking it, and it knows where the robot is. It was fairly straightforward calculation within Motion Builder to, you know, pick the root node of the robot and calculate its straight line distance to the camera frame by frame and then display that value. So the camera system actually had two displays constantly updating on a frame-by-frame basis, telling him distance from camera to the two robots so he could focus on the robots that weren't there.
So literally it was saying the robots right now are 3 meters away from the lens, so if you want to set the lens to 3 meters, you're going to get them in focus, kind of thing.
Yep. And we opted to do that rather than have him focus on the background and let us put it out of focus, just because it would be more realistic. And there were times when we did focus pulls, you know, from the robots to Hugh and the kid in the background or vice versa, and I wanted to do those in camera. So for Larry, our focus puller, to do that, he'd need to know spatially where the robots are. And it worked great, and he could see the robots on the monitor because he's getting the same feed that the camera operator is. But just having that readout, because, you know, normally they're using the corner of their eye to look at the subject directly. Well, there's nothing out there, so it was sort of helping him, giving him that information that normally he gets out of the corner of his eye. We were giving it to him as a readout on his monitor.
So I guess the only person that didn't have that luxury of having a virtualized view of what was happening in the ring when acting to a empty ring was someone like Hugh Jackman themselves. But I guess that was helped by the fact that Hugh has actually done a few effects films and seems to be quite technically literate.
Right. And, well, Hugh and all the extras, and that was one of the biggest challenges, was getting everybody to look in the right place. And that's where our first AD, Josh McLaughlin, came in with his tennis ball on a stick, and he would have a monitor showing him the composite with the robots, and he would fly his tennis ball on a stick in to where the robot or robots' heads were. And we maybe only did it for a rehearsal. Sometimes we did it during the shot. And a lot of times the top of the frame was going to get replaced with our crowd extensions anyway. So he was able to keep the ball in the, basically in the robot's head as we shot and sort of animate it as we went. And that gave everybody around the ring a place to look. Without that, you know, people would be looking everywhere. And we did have a couple of instances where there were some stray eye lines that we had to go to great lengths to correct. There was a shot where Hugh and Dakota and Adam enter the zoo, and we walk past this row of people, and one of the women in the row just looks in completely the wrong place. We had to digitally basically cut her head off and retrack her head from a different part of the shot back onto her to get her to look in the right place, because she was right in the middle of frame as the robot walked by and she was looking off who knows where. But for the most part, by giving them an eye line, using the virtual the virtual composite, we were able to keep the eye lines where they belonged.
Actually, there's one sequence we didn't talk about, which I just want to touch on, which is the bullfighting with the robot at the beginning of the film, the kind of rodeo. Could you talk about that sequence? Was there ever a real bull?
Oh, yeah. It's a combination. The one thing that I have to point out about the real bull, we had half a dozen bulls, but only two of them made it into the movie, and really there was only one that gave us any kind of performance at all, and that one bull only had one horn because the bull was mental. I mean, completely off his rocker, which is what made him such a great performer. He always had plenty of energy and was willing to attack anything you put in front of him. And
so not a good idea to get in there and take lots of reference stills close up then.
He's always shooting through a gate, and you get too close to him, and he would attack you. But he was so psychotic that he broke his own horn off. Obviously, we needed a bull with two horns, so there are some shots that would have been straight photography, but we had to put a horn back on the real bull.
I assumed it was not a real bull, simply because you would never treat an animal that way, and you wouldn't do it ethically, but also you wouldn't do it and get away with ever the film being released. So,
No, there are a handful of shots. There are shots that just have the bull, him coming out of the gate, him before they let him out of the chute, that weren't going to be visual effect shots, but we had to put a horn on him. But also there are a couple of shots that have bull and robot not in contact, but there's a shot where the robot is walking away from us, and the bull is charging him, and that's a real bull. He doesn't get to him in that shot, obviously, but that's a real bull shot.
All that dirt and dust and stuff that was being kicked up was just CG stuff added on the robots when they were walking and doing stuff, or was there any sort of practical on-set stuff?
It was a combination of CG elements and photographic dust elements, but mostly CG. We have the library of photographic dust elements that we use as a sort of a sweetener.
Because I just imagine that it would be an annoyance to actually go to the trouble of rigging all these mechanical things on set, only then to discover that the timing of the footsteps wasn't right. So, or the
step wasn't right. In the bull ring, all that you know, every foot fall for a robot and it kicks up dust, that's all put in digitally.
By the way, when you were doing iRobot, you did it in Maya and obviously rendered it in RenderMan. Was that the same on this, or was it?
We used V-Ray this time around.
Okay.
And it worked great.
Yep. Well, just in finishing up then, in comparison to iRobot, did it feel like you had about the same amount of time? Was the crew about the same kind of size? Or how did those two stack up just in terms of production, in broad terms?
In terms of our visual effects shot production?
Sir.
I think it was a somewhat smaller team on Real Steel. Shot count was probably, I think the shot counts were pretty similar. I think there was a lot less, I think on Real Steel we got a lot more of our work on the screen. I think there was less wasted effort, just because, to a large degree, because of the efficiencies and all of the upfront work that is done in the virtual production pipeline. There was a lot. I mean, basically, before we went to Detroit, we knew what the shots were. And Sean was great in terms of when we choreographed, captured, and did the virtual camera and edited the fight sequences, he took that completely seriously. He was like, he was making the movie. It wasn't like, well, this is previs and this is an idea and we'll change it later. He was committed, and when we went and shot the plates, there was no waffling about. It was just like, no, this is the shot. He had lived with the sequence for a couple of months, you know, had refined the edit and, you know, had lived with it long enough that he was confident that this was the sequence, so that when it came to shooting the plates, it was literally paint by numbers. I mean, this is the frame range for the animations, so we know what mocap to play back. This shot starts here, ends here, 25 millimeter lens, steady cam in the ring. We knew all of those things, and that allowed us to shoot plates very efficiently. And then they could turn the sequence over, you know, sometimes within a week or two of shooting the plates. And we had a very good temp, and we had motion capture that, to go along with it. And from there, it was just refining the animation, refining lighting, and, I mean, incredibly efficient way of working.
Well, look, as I say, I really enjoyed the film. I just thought it was great fun, and it was superbly integrated CG. I know you guys have done a lot of that, but it really was so hard for me to keep reminding myself that that a lot of this must have been shot empty. So thanks so much for taking time to talk to us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Well, thanks, Mike, and thanks to Eric. I really enjoy the way this stuff has progressed, moving, you know, away from just shooting plates, random raw plates that we then have to sort out and figure out, to being able to visualize and shoot in ways that make everybody's job better. And as it sounds, this film really pulls it together in that regard. And the cinematography side, being able to visualize things on the set in a way that we never would have imagined years ago. Also, I have to say, I really enjoyed Eric giving a shout out to digital shooting. We so often hear people, you know, waxing nostalgic about film, and to hear somebody mention the lack of dirt, scratches, and just the general workflow benefits of digital. I mean, it's certainly been the reality now for quite a while, but, you know, we tend to get nostalgic about film and talk about the good old days of film. And yet I really, it's just nice to hear somebody, you know, give a shout out to the digital side. Also, that nuke gag where they populated the stadium, you also should check out the article over on FX Guide about Moneyball, because Rhythm and Hughes did a similar process. Very clever stuff. Interesting to hear in these days where everything is often done with massive and, you know, just put some CG extras in there. A couple people doing a clever solution to such a gag that we have to do all the time. Anyway, that'll do it for this FX podcast. For my partners Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, this is Jeff Huser. We'll see you on the next FX podcast.
please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.